Welcome to the Fuller Tracy Money Audio Commentary. This is Owen Tracy recording. It is 2:02 p.m. that is Pacific Summer Time. Today is May 1st, and today being Friday, it's the big picture long-term audio and video for the various different asset classes. What I thought we'd focus on today would be to look at major tops and bottoms, and particularly type 1, type 2, and type 3 tops and bottoms, because at this point where we've seen some, just about everything has pulled back, then some assets have rebounded in a very impressive manner, others in a much less impressive manner, and do we have therefore bottoming activity, or is there topping activity, or where are we in terms of the longer term cycle? These are, I think, the big questions that we need to at least have some framework to answer, if we don't in fact come up with concrete answers, because we don't have enough of evidence yet. But certainly we need to have a framework into which we might be able to fit answers so that we can come up with a plan about how to think about the markets going forward. Well, I thought I would kick off with the NASDAQ 100 because it is by far the most important of all the major global markets right now, not least because it plays home to the vast majority of the mega cap companies. And the mega cap companies have been a very significant contributor to performance in the S&P 500 over the course of the last little bit more than a month. Microsoft, Apple, Amazon, Alphabet are among the four largest companies in the world. They tack on Facebook in there, and we can see that they've been up in a meaningful way, but more importantly, then, because of their relative size inside the index, then they represent a significant weighting. The five largest companies in the world, and particularly the five big technology companies, represent about 20% of the S&P 500 and 40% of the NASDAQ 100. And that's a very significant concentration of performance and weighting in a small number of companies. And the NASDAQ playing home to the majority of them, and also giving them a double weighting relative to the S&P 500, does help to highlight just how dependent on those big companies the major indices are for performance. Well, now let's think about, well, what have we been presented with? We had a consistent trend, and the biggest consistency was that every time we had one of these longer ranges, when it was resolved on the upside, it never pulled back into the underlying range. And the only example that really broke that trend was in 2015 and 16, and again in 2018. So there were occasions when bigger reactions break the two-year uptrends, and there were two-year uptrends that were quite well defined. Generally speaking, in a secular bull market, the bigger pullbacks are some of the best buying opportunities that we're presented with. So when we had the bigger pullback in December of 2018, investors concluded that this was a good buying opportunity. The Federal Reserve stepped in and started cutting interest rates, and then we rallied right back up to the top, consolidated for about 6 months, and then broke out in a very dramatic fashion, and following the breakouts. And the other thing, of course, is that on previous occasions, when something has had the larger pullbacks, we've seen these little consolidations in the region of the upper side of the range. And we'd had that for most of 2019, and then it broke on the upside. If this was going to remain a consistent or a reasonably consistent medium-term trend, then it should have held that breakout. But it didn't. It failed to sustain the upward break. We've had a massive reaction against the prevailing trend. And that's a very significant factor. It's a type 2 top formation characteristic. I think it's very obvious when we look at a point and figure chart that we had a reasonably consistent trend. There was a hiccup in 2018, but subsequent to that, the market pushed on and continued to post higher highs and higher lows. Then it really did accelerate up and out of that range and came all the way back and broke the sequence of higher reaction lows. And now we've had an additional rebound. So it would be hard to now conclude that this is still a consistent trend. So it's no longer a consistent trend. Then the question that has to be asked is, well, if it's not a consistent trend, do we have topping activity? Well, the massive reaction against the prevailing trend is a type 2 top characteristic. So it's probably good to, or I think a suitable time to start thinking about, well, what are the main trend-ending characteristics? The first one, number one, is acceleration, and it can happen either up or down, and how large the acceleration is generally an indication of whether we have seen a top or the top. But acceleration is probably best defined as a trend ending of undetermined duration. The second one is, of course, it would be very easy to think that all markets accelerate up and accelerate down, but they don't. Then sometimes we can have a trend that is progressing reasonably well. Maybe we might see a loss of momentum on occasion, but the massive reaction against a prevailing trend is a type 2 characteristic because it is the proverbial bolt from the blue. And it takes such a short time to fall such a long way that people have very little time to react. Very few people get to sell out at the top. There are still a lot of people who've got a lot of inventory. And then there are also going to be people who think, well, golly, I've been waiting for a pullback. And every other time there's been a pullback like this over the course of the bull market, it's a buying opportunity. So then they buy. And the massive reaction against the prevailing trend is often followed by a range because people use the rally to liquidate positions, whereas there are still going to be people who want to buy the dip. So that's the type 2 top. Well, then you've got the type 3 top, and it tends to be more like a big range. So there's a clear loss of momentum. It becomes very volatile, and there is it's defined by ranging, by time, and by size because they tend to be large patterns. And I think we've got ample evidence of all of those right now. The difference, however, when looking at a longer-term chart is that a type 3 bottom is going to look like a long, I think very narrow range. And it looks narrow because the size of the pullback compresses the data. When you look at it on a logarithmic scale, then it exaggerates the peak to trough swings within the base. But now if we think about the Nasdaq, well, it's a type 2 top formation. So we've had the massive reaction against the prevailing trend. And then we've had the people that have certainly wanted to buy the dip, and that has been primarily characterized by retail investors. So, I mean, in the last 3 weeks, I've had one person at the UPS office in particular, young guy, 25 years old, offering me stock advice. And that's never happened before, but he was very proud of himself that he had bought Microsoft in March, and he's obviously done rather well from that. Now, when we look at Microsoft, then we have to ask ourselves, do we have evidence of type 1, type 2, or type 3? Well, I think it stands out quite clearly that there was acceleration, that the price went from approximately $100 to $190 in the space of little more than a year. And particularly in the last portion of the advance, where it went from approximately 140 to 190 in the space of just a few months. So there was a clear acceleration and a wide overextension relative to the trend mean, and the subsequent pullback has been very acute, and it came all the way back to the trend mean and bounced. And equally important is that it rallied impressively. So this is, I think, one of the better examples of an acceleration on the downside, a massive reaction against the prevailing trend because of the acceleration, which could still be a reasonably consistent trend on the upside because of the size of the rebound. It has ample space in which to consolidate. I think I will continue to look at point and figure charts just for contrast and to give us some just to clear out some of the noise, because when we look at, for example, Microsoft, it still has the sequence of higher reaction lows over the decade. Now, there is no questioning that we have had a massive pullback, but we've had an equally impressive rebound. Now, the question, though, is when we think about Microsoft, could it subsequently range? And will it then go into a lengthier period of ranging before it can sustain a move to new all-time highs? I think that's probably the most important question, because it's going to be difficult to say, well, where is the new good news going to come from? There is no doubt that when we look at what's likely to form or what way in which the economy is going to evolve as a result of the reaction to the coronavirus, well, I think it is likely that people are going to be spending more time working from home, less time in the office, and certainly offices will be less concentrated. But the bigger picture is that these types of companies that offer cloud services are likely to do well. And that's, I think, one of the reasons why I think investors have been favoring the cloud computing sector, because it does hold out the prospect of benefiting in a recession, simply because companies will be looking to do more with less, and that kind of efficiency by farming out responsibility for the back end will certainly be attractive. But it's not all companies are going to do well, and certainly the benefit so far has very much accreted to the largest companies. Because when we look at an ETF for cloud computing, we're not presented with the same type of consistent trend that we had with Microsoft. And part of the reason for that is because there are obviously a lot more companies, but then there are also different types of companies. It's not simply data center providers, but it's also the companies that depend on the growth in the data center business to generate their sales. But when we then think about the difference in the trend between Microsoft and the cloud computing ETF, well, then we can see clearly that there is a difference, that the cloud computing ETF had been ranging higher. It had been dipping back into its underlying ranges. Then it popped on the upside and had a much larger pullback. Now, again, here we have the massive reaction against the prevailing trend. Now, one thing that I think is appropriate to highlight right now is that when we have these kinds of moves, then what is, I think, important to highlight is consistent trends very often lose their consistency at the penultimate high. Now, if we then think about the S&P 500, we've certainly seen the big pullback here as well. And the big decline that we had in 2018. It broke the sequence of higher reaction lows and it set up another one of these lengthier pauses. It has now sustained a move below the 1,000-day moving average, rallied back up to the 200-day moving average, and has now begun to exhibit some resistance. And it was down almost 3% in here today. Now, the sequence of higher reaction lows off the low in March is still intact, but there's ample scope for profit-taking in here. And when we think about what could potentially happen, and the big question, of course, then is this a type 1, 2, or 3? Well, we don't really have an acceleration. There's an enormous difference between an acceleration following an already well-developed trend and one where we get an acceleration up and out of a range. Ranges are explosions waiting to happen. We anticipate that you're going to have an impressive rally out of a range, and that's exactly what we had in the latter part of 2019, ahead of this massive reaction against the prevailing trend. So I would like to come back and talk a little bit more about the range that forms following a type 2 top, because we've got lots of different examples of that. The other point, of course, is that it's important to think about markets in a fractal manner, because if this is a type 2 top and we've had the massive reaction against the prevailing trend, well, that's very evident on the 10-year weekly chart. If we zoom in, well, what we've actually then also got is an acceleration on the downside. So that's a type 1 trend ending, but of course, an acceleration is an ending of undetermined duration. And how we see those type 1 trend endings resolved gives us some idea about what we might anticipate in the immediate aftermath. First, thinking about the type 2 top, then we've had the massive reaction, we've had the rebound. Definitely there were people coming in and buying the dip, and anyone who bought the dip has made money. Now they are obviously going to have to answer the question, is it worth holding on or is it worth to take the profit today? And particularly as we get back up towards the 200-day moving average. Well, the 200-day moving average is the first area of potential resistance, and we're now seeing some evidence that resistance is being encountered for indices that have got up to that level. Now, how much of this advance is it going to hold during any period of consolidation? Well, we've had a meaningful rebound, so there is room in which to consolidate and still hold the low. I do think it is likely that the S&P 500 will hold its low, but we are probably going to move into a more volatile phase right now. When we think about what are the bullish factors, well, there's been a massive amount of liquidity made available to investors, so that's certainly positive. There are still people willing to buy the dip, that's certainly positive. There's been a short covering rally. So there was estimations this week that futures traders had pretty much unwound all of their short positions into this week. So that also tells us that the short covering rally has pretty much run its course, but it was a powerful factor in pushing the market higher. Now, we know that in a type 2 top, very few people have an opportunity to sell. They're blindsided, and they don't sell because they can't believe that the market will go down so quickly. So they're left hanging with a lot of their inventory. The last thing anybody wants to do is to sell at the low, so they wait for a rally. And as we get back up towards the first area of potential resistance, well, then it's really quite normal that people might willingly then sell, considering that at the price right now is not all that different to where prices were back in September, before all of this uncertainty evolved. We are obviously in a very different environment today than we were back in November. On the one hand, there is a massive amount of liquidity being provided, but on the other, there's a really good need for it because of the uncertainty that is arising because of the coronavirus. And we don't yet know how well economies are going to bounce back when there are still social distancing measures put in place for all kinds of social activities. One of the primary reasons that people like going to the pub is for live music and to sample the atmosphere. And the atmosphere is created by lots of people milling around. Well, that pretty much drives a nail into the coffin of the pub sector. Then it's similar for restaurants. It's nice to be in a restaurant that's full of people. And we also go there for the quality of the food and the quality of the service. And quite whether we can have the same quality of food and service when the servers are with masks and gloves and then serving us food with gloved hands. Well, obviously, white glove service is something that we generally pay considerably more for. And there's a good chance that that's eventually what's going to happen, that restaurants are just not going to be able to sustain a fast service environment, and that gloved service is going to become more expensive. But the big picture, of course, is that this is a very different environment to what we had 6 months ago, and prices are pretty much the same today now as they were then. And is that truly justifiable? Isn't it, I think, reasonable that we should have a period of consolidation and ranging where these questions get more fully answered? Now, one thing that we saw in here today, which I thought was particularly interesting, was that one of the best performing shares in the market, Amazon, had its earnings last night. I was anticipating that they were going to have to announce some additional measures to contain the risk that they have. The price was down in a pretty dynamic manner in here today. But one thing that was particularly interesting is Jeff Bezos coming out and saying that investors should take a seat. Because they're going to be disappointed. There's going to be bad news coming, and that the company's probably going to have a loss in the second quarter. Well, I think that's about as close as we get to a CEO saying sell the stock, except for Tesla, where Elon Musk basically said, in fact, he did say, that the stock is too high. But one thing we can see certainly with Amazon is that it broke on the upside, and it is due some consolidation. But as long as it's holding the breakout, I don't think anyone's going to be especially worried about it. Then when we think about Tesla, this is a company that has been subject to incredible volatility. But it was particularly interesting that the share found support around the $400 area and rebounded, and now I think it is likely we're going to have another volatile range forming, because that's what Tesla does. It has these very volatile ranges, and the percentage moves that it puts in are really quite incredible. But of course, the important point is that Amazon's trend is still reasonably consistent. I think it's particularly relevant to look at it on a logarithmic scale. It's one of the clearest buy the dip strategies for investors over the course of the last decade, and it has broken up and out of this range and got all the way up to approximately $2,500. It's important to highlight that it paused at 1,000. It found support more or less around 1,500, paused at 2,000. The logical place for it to encounter resistance again was 2,500. It has done that. So now we're likely to see another step form. As long as it's forming another step, then I think investors are going to be reasonably sanguine. So we don't have top formation development here. Now, when we then think about some of the other markets, because obviously not everything has done this well. When we look, go back and think about that initial graphic I shared, where the performance of the stock market has been so heavily concentrated in these large cap shares, well, it's worth considering that lots of other shares have, or indices, have not just had a type 2 top formation. When we look at the Russell 2000, that massive reaction against the prevailing trend was back in 2018. It pulled back in a much more dynamic manner than it had done in a long time, subsequently rebounded, and then went sideways for a whole year, popped on the upside, and then crashed down. So that's a very significant evolution, because not only do we have the type 1 or the type 2 top, where the massive reaction against the prevailing trend happened against a background where the market had been trending reasonably consistently, we have the period of right hand extension which lasted a year, and then we get this additional crash lower. And importantly, now the index is encountering resistance in the region of the lower side of the overhead trading range. And that's reminiscent of the very first charting example that we use at the chart seminar. So now we have type 2 top formations with right hand extension, and then we get the additional step lower. Now, the big determination as to whether this is a completed top formation with more to go on the downside, or is it likely to go sideways and then go up again, is going to be how well does it hold that psychological 1,000-point level on the current retracement. It retraced approximately half of the decline this year, and now the big question is, will it hold the 1,000-point level during a consolidation? But we are likely to see some consolidation. And what I find particularly interesting is this is very similar to the kinds of charts we have just about everywhere else. Now, when we think about the trend in the FTSE 100, it was going sideways for 3 years, and the range was between 6,500 and 8,000. So we have type 3 top formation characteristics here. Then it rallied impressively to get from 5 to just over 6,000. Then we had a key day reversal yesterday and downside follow through in here today. Now it is still holding the sequence of higher reaction lows off the low in March, but the fact that it has not been able to rebound all the way back up into the highs tells us that there's more going on here, that there is more weakness, that there is. The big question is, will it hold the 5,000 level? And are we going to go into a much lengthier period of consolidation? This is equally true of markets like the Euro Stoxx Index. And when we look at the size of these pullbacks, not only do we have this huge breakdown from, in this case, a near 5-year range, but also the size of the rebounds has been not an especially impressive advance. So we get the massive reaction, we get the acceleration on the downside, but then the size of the rally is modest. Now, it's not as modest as we've seen, for example, in the banking sector. When we think about how do accelerations end, well, a market can accelerate down and it can accelerate back up, but most particularly when we see a very modest rebound following a persistent decline. I mean, we think about the banking sector went down on consecutive days for the better part of 3 weeks. Well, the potential for it to simply push on to new lows is much more likely for indices or sectors or shares that have not experienced impressive rebounds. And that's true of banking sectors just about everywhere. Then we have these kinds of patterns that we have on the S&P 500 Banks Index. We had the massive reaction against the prevailing trend. Now we have this little pennant formation where we have got a very clear sequence of higher reaction lows, but an inability to continue to push on to new highs. And now the price is coming back down. Well, if this sequence of higher reaction lows is broken, then it's very likely we're going to go straight down to new lows. And I think that's one of the potential hazards during any period of consolidation, that the weakest sectors are likely to go bust first, or they're likely to move on to new lows first. That's most likely today with the banking sector. When we look at, for example, the worst performers on the S&P 500 today, one that really caught my eye in terms of the performance of the share has been Highmarsh and Payne. So we can see, for example, that it had this catastrophic decline and a very mild rebound, and now is coming down to test the sequence of higher reaction lows. If it doesn't bounce on Monday, it's quite likely to be at a new low by the end of next week. And this is the kind of bearish consolidation that we do get following accelerations, that an acceleration can be an ending of near-term significance, and then we can get an additional acceleration later. And of course, there are certain parts of the energy sector are going to come under extraordinary pressure because of the massive decline that we've had in the oil price. And Brent crude has probably found support around 20. It's up in a meaningful fashion in here this week. And commodities do not go to zero, but commodity producers and commodity service companies can go to zero, and it's quite likely that some will. Now, if we then look at some of these exact same charts on a point and figure basis, well, oil prices are particularly relevant to the wider global economy. And even though we've had a rebound of $5 in here this week, it is not yet showing up on a 10-year chart in terms of the point and figure. If we just take out some of the data, then we still haven't had enough of a rally to change the trend overall. And it's going to require a somewhat larger rally in order to break the downtrend from a point and figure perspective, even though I think it is very likely that $20 is probably going to be the low of significance for the Brent crude price. Then if we go back and look at what do the European indices look like on a point and figure basis, then we clearly see that we've got these massive reactions. And these huge reactions against the prevailing trend, they're very reminiscent of the kinds of pullbacks that we saw in 2008 for the banking sector. And when we then think about, well, what are the risks? Well, one of the reasons why the FTSE has been so acutely hit is because of its reliance on the energy sector. But the Eurostox index has also had this catastrophic decline. Now, the most likely scenario is that we're going to have a period of right-hand extension, and support building will be required in order to reinvigorate investor confidence. We've had a very significant short covering rally. The chances are that we're at the end of that. We're likely to have some consolidation. It's the ability of these markets to find support at progressively higher levels and hold the majority of their rebounds is going to be the primary characteristic that will support the view that the lows are in. But for the for the instruments that have not experienced meaningful rebounds, well, then there's very little to conclude that we are at the end of the loss taking stage. Now, an accelerated decline is going to end in one of two different ways. We're either going to accelerate down and get a big pop on the upside, which will close out the shorts, and then we get a period of ranging, and the ranging has an upward bias, and then we get a breakout on the upside. Or we get less of an impressive rally, and the downward bias is continued to be sustained. We get a period of right-hand extension that has got a sequence of lower lows, but that the market loses momentum. Eventually, we get a massive reaction against the prevailing downtrend, and we get a big rally on the upside. It's exactly that a kind of condition that represented the lows in 2009. This is one of the most important points. I've seen a number of people talking about what are the potential outcomes over the course of the next few months. And people are already talking about that we're not going to have any kind of significant pullback and that the lows are not going to be tested. But I think it is worth highlighting that the big acceleration on the downside happened in the period in September and October of 2008. We had a new low in November, and then we had another new low in March. And finally, we had the massive reaction against the prevailing trend into the June period, and then it never looked back. It started to find support in the region of the 200-day moving average and rallied. Well, we're still a long way from the 200-day moving average for the vast majority of indices. On this occasion, the S&P needs to sustain a move back above that level, but it's just encountered resistance in the region of it. I think the most likely scenario now for the S&P is that it's going to range, and that the range will probably be above the lows, but below the 200-day EMA, and eventually we'll then see a rally above it. The massive amount of money that's being printed is most likely to contribute to higher asset prices overall. For the other markets around the world, then what we're being presented with is a different environment. For example, when we look at the Nikkei, it ranged above 2000 in a 20% range for the better part of 3 years, then it broke downwards, and now it has encountered resistance in the region of the lower side of the overhead range. The minimum requirement is that it is going to have to sustain a move above 20,000, then back above the 200-day moving average. But that's probably a big ask in the short term, and that we're likely to see a retest of the low before we see a significant rebound. And that's also clearly evident in the point and figure chart, where we have this volatile range, massive reaction against the prevailing trend, and now we're starting to get this period of right-hand extension. Then whether it can push back above 20,000 or it will ultimately fail and start to trend downwards again is something that will be determined later. The one market that has type 3 bottoming characteristics is gold shares. And here we have the massive acceleration on the downside in 2012 and 13. The market bottomed in 2016, then went into this we had the massive reaction against the prevailing downtrend. We get a period of right-hand extension, so we have the type 1 bottom, we have the type 2 trend-ending characteristic, then that turned into a long type 3 bottom overall, 7 years where it has been ranging, and then it has broken upwards in just the last couple of weeks. Now, Again, this I think is the most important point. When we think about, well, where is the easy money? Where are the trends that are going to be easy to follow? Where are the trends that are not already over-egged? And then we look at the performance of wider markets, of national indices, where we've had these massive reactions and a great deal of uncertainty. And then we look and contrast that with sectors that are just starting to break on the upside. And gold shares are obviously setting the pace here, where they were not immune from the pullback in March, but they have now rallied enough to completely unwind the oversold condition and have pushed on to new high ground. And really, a sustained move below the 200-day moving average would be required to question that this isn't a completed type 3 base formation. And type 3 bases, generally, when they're completed, most particularly when a whole sector completes a base together, then that's generally indicative of a new bull market. So we have to then think about, well, what is the rationale behind all of this? We know, for example, that the response by governments and central banks the world over is to print money. So that's obviously one of the factors that's helping to drive gold. Not only is the supply of money increasing, but that we have negative real interest rates. Inflationary pressures have not disappeared, even though we are still at a point where deflation is likely overall, then the willingness of central banks to stimulate is even greater than the deflationary pressures. And that's a necessary condition if they want to reinvigorate growth. So we still have negative real interest rates. That's likely to persist for a substantial period of time. Well, for an asset that doesn't pay an interest rate, when there are negative real interest rates, then it comes out ahead just by default. So that's one of the reasons why gold is continuing to march higher. It's also worth, I think, looking at the gold price on a point and figure basis, because we are presented with a market that is leading the shares higher. And it had an almost identical base formation. When we then think about, and I think it is just, let me do that again and compare and contrast the shape of gold's base formation with that of gold shares. Well, then we can, I think, clearly see that gold has been leading on the upside and has got a very similar pattern overall. And it pushed on to new high ground in here today. It has continued to firm around the 700 area, but on a point and figure basis, this looks like nothing more than a consolidation. Now, there are important characteristics that are, I think, worth highlighting about gold. One is, of course, that it does tend to be volatile, but the most important is that it can't be printed into existence. And it spent an awfully long time not doing much of anything. When it started to do particularly well was in the middle of 2019. Like any type 3 base formation, there are going to be false dawns. This is something that we notice quite often with a developing base formation, is that there will be failed upside breaks. There will be times when it looks particularly likely to pop on the upside only to fail. But once we start to see an upward bias to the trading, then that's particularly relevant to the theory that accumulation is underway. But then when we do get the breakout, we very often get a range forming after the breakout. And the fact that a range can form at historically high prices is very encouraging from a bull market perspective. And then subsequently, we move on to a more consistent trending environment. And that are actually, more often than not, you get a choppy trending environment, which eventually becomes, consistent. That's one of the reasons where we can, or I think one of the things we can observe as a trend develops, that the trend should become more consistent. In fact, that's exactly what happened with gold into the peak in 2011. It had a well-defined uptrend all the way up from approximately 2002 onwards, but the early part of the advance was rather choppy, and it did require faith. Then we did have these explosive moves on the upside and 18-month consolidations, and that whole process lasted for about 7 years. It was only really after the financial crisis that gold really started to trend in a very rhythmic fashion, and eventually it did accelerate. We're now in the choppy part of the advance. As more people become convinced of the bull market hypothesis, then the trend will become more consistent because there will be increasing demand for the assets. And a wide imbalance between supply and demand is what creates a bull market. And now we think about the fact that there is an enormous amount of debt outstanding. And governments are, on the one hand, they are printing money to rescue the economy and rescue the consumer and rescue companies. And the Federal Reserve, in particular, is also trying to rescue the global financial system. There is, I think this was a particularly interesting graphic I saw today, where it is charting the credit to non-bank borrowers in US dollars as a percentage of their GDP. So Chile and Argentina, but Turkey and Mexico have got substantial proportions of their GDP that are denominated in US dollar debt. Then graphed against the performance of the currency, and the lower is the worst performer. So Brazil has got a particularly badly performing currency, but it's only got about 10% of its debt denominated in US dollars. Mexico's currency has been doing modestly better, but nearly 25% of the economy is denominated in dollars, and the Turkish lira is in a similar condition. The big difference, of course, is that Mexico has got a substantial proportion of its income is derived in US dollars, where that's not specifically true of Turkey. And of course, then we have South Africa, where you've got both a weak currency and a comparatively high source of stress in US dollar denominated debt. So it's not simply that countries are responding to the coronavirus, but also there has been a dearth of dollars because the Federal Reserve was printing currency, and now they've been under stress for a while. Now they're under even more stress. The problem that the globe faces today is that a number of the emerging markets are further behind in the timeline for combating the coronavirus than the rest of the world. So we have an uneven spread of the coronavirus, and some countries are being hit worse than others. And I think the best way of looking at it is in the performance of the respective currencies. So the Brazilian real is still trending lower against the US dollar. The South African rand is still in a downtrend. When we then think about the Turkish lira, those were all countries that appear in that graphic. Well, it's also worth reminding ourselves that a number of the ASEAN markets have currencies that are reasonably steady. The Vietnamese stock market has not been spared from the pullback in the wider market, but Vietnam has been among the most efficient countries in curtailing the spread of the virus. Now the big question is the low going to hold? Is the export model going to be able to hold up when the rest of the global economy is experiencing a great deal of stress? This is one of the primary reasons why China has been trying to develop their domestic economy, because they don't want to have to rely on the wider global economy. But their domestic economy is still under a great deal of stress. When we then think about what the long-term prognosis is, well, the competition between the current global hegemon, which is the USA, and China, which wants to try and take over that position, is only going to intensify. And the monetary financing that is currently underway, which is variously described as modern monetary theory or helicopter money, is only going to be exacerbated because a number of countries have tried austerity and it didn't work in any measurable way to help improve the living standards of their populations. And ultimately, that is the end rationale for any kind of economic model. So now they're going for the populist route. And in some countries, that's been a left-wing populism, and in others, it's right-wing populism. The markets certainly prefer the latter. But ultimately, when we look at the competition that is arising as a result of that, the nationalism that is being stoked, and the potential that that is going to cause strife in the global trade network, there is the clear potential that there is going to be a war eventually. One thing that I find particularly interesting is when we look at the news stories where there are UFO or videos that the U.S. military have confirmed are real, then that's, I think, one of the rather interesting developments. When, for example, we look at these videos, and they've been circulating now for approximately, I'm just going to try and drag this chart over. When we think about these news stories, we've seen these kinds of news stories coming up over most of the last 3 or 4 years, but there's an eerie similarity in time between heightened stress between the USA and China and the coming out of media stories about these unidentified flying objects. It is a none too subtle indicator that the US military is trying to tell the rest of the world without telling them that they have got an inside line or they have got a different way of addressing global threats that isn't entirely public. Now, that's something that is quite interesting. Because when we think about what is going on in terms of the global economy, then the big stabilizing factor in terms of the Thucydides paradox has been nuclear weapons. And the question that is never really addressed is, what would a country do if it has the ability to completely counteract another country's or another country's nuclear capability. Now, that's something that is going to be explored, I think, in the next decade. This isn't something that's going to go away. China is building a blue water navy, and they are very much intent on expressing their views internationally, and the kind of coronavirus mask diplomacy that's been deployed over the course of the last 2 months is just another example of their willingness to encroach upon democracies. Well, these UFO sightings, I strongly believe, are a none too subtle effort by the US military to signal that they have got something that the world is not willing to talk about just yet. and it's probably highly advanced drone technology. The one of the greatest limiting factors of jet planes right now is the attempt to try and keep the pilot conscious while it is while whatever plane they're flying is underway. If you get rid of the pilot, then the limitations on what a an aircraft can do become much less burdensome. I suspect that that is probably what we're looking at. One thing that we know is that having the global reserve currency is an extraordinary privilege for the US government and for the US economy generally. Now, the US dollar index has been ranging in a rather volatile manner for the better part of 5 years, and we have just seen a failed break above 100. I think this is another good example of a chart that we should be looking at in terms of the point and figure charts. No country wants a strong currency, but I think we can clearly see that we had the significant pop on the upside, a loss of momentum, failed upside breaks. This is looking increasingly like a Type 3 top formation, and there is the potential that we are going to see it move significantly lower. China is also trying to devalue their currency, and it was down in a meaningful fashion in here today, and not least because of an intensification of the rhetoric between the Trump administration and the Chinese government. We can definitely see a potential outcome that one of the ways that the economy is going to eventually break out into higher growth rates is through a war effort. Now, quite whether that war effort is in the short term, the medium term, or the long term is completely open to question. I would suggest that China is not ready for a war yet. From a military planner's perspective, then that would probably be the ideal time to put pressure on them before they're ready for a war. So that again opens the question: what does a country do when they have developed technology that makes another country's nuclear arsenal obsolete? They would have a compelling rationale to deploy it immediately to gain maximum possible advantage. Now, that is a potential outcome that is certainly not being discussed, is certainly not something that is in the realm of the realizable in the short term. But it is something that we do need to pay attention to because the stories about UFOs only seem to come out when the relationship between the USA and China deteriorates. So that, I think, is a clear trend that's evolving. That's something we need to pay attention to on the horizon of what's possible. Now, when we think about, well, how is the current challenge going to be surmounted eventually? The second quarter is going to be particularly deleterious, and there's a good chance that a lot of that bad news is already in the price. Some sectors are going to do substantially better than others, and technological innovation is not going to suddenly be sidelined because of the coronavirus. In fact, the biotech sector has been ranging for 5 years and is coming up to the upper side of its range. Now, it was in negative territory in here today, and it is overbought in the short term. We're quite likely to see some consolidation. But this trend looks nothing like the performance of some of the energy companies or the banking sector or the well, let me see if I can get the correct chart. Royal Caribbean Cruises, for example, is a good example of the Type 3 top formation, acceleration on the downside. We've now had the short covering rally. The share was down in a very dynamic manner in here today. Now, if this is the low, then this is a good candidate for the kind of company that could go sideways in another, in a type 3 bottoming characteristic for a very prolonged period of time. And you do need to look at it on a logarithmic scale to really see the size element of a developing type 3 bottom, because it is quite normal that a type 3 bottom will have a 100% move from trough to peak, and that's exactly what we've had with Royal Caribbean. There is the real potential that a number of these travel related companies or airlines, and not least because of the loss of the buyback initiative, is going to result in type 3 bottoming characteristics for a number of the companies that are at the epicenter of risk. And perhaps that's the biggest answer, that the companies that are at the epicenter of risk, which in this case is the travel and hospitality sectors, are those that are most likely to have the type 3 sleeper base formation. The sectors that bounce back fastest from the initial decline are those that are likely to lead in the next bull market. And quite clearly, that is gold and technology at the moment. But then we also have the issue with US dollar denominated debt in the emerging markets. And that's obviously going to be a problem for some countries more than others. The ability of countries to react and prosper after the coronavirus is going to set up important buying opportunities. India, for example, extended its lockdown by an additional 2 weeks in here today. They obviously have to get over their problem with the coronavirus, but it could well be the catalyst that will contribute to more infrastructure development, more manufacturing capacity. These are the kinds of things that a good crisis shouldn't be allowed to go to waste. Those are the kinds of things that could potentially power India through into a new era of prosperity after the coronavirus. But perhaps we're not quite there yet. When we think about what are the odds, then we're likely to have a period of consolidation. Certainly, there are going to be indices that do better than others. How well they hold their lows is going to be the defining characteristic. There are going to be some of the weaker sectors move on to new lows, and eventually will give us better bottoming characteristics, but perhaps not quite yet. And I think with that, I will leave you for the weekend and wish all the best to all of you.